So the koan is, in the old days, there were 16 bodhisattvas. When it was time to bathe, they got into the bath together. They suddenly realized the cause of water and said, "This subtle touch releases the brightness. We have become the sons and daughters of the house of the Buddha." So in this talk tonight, I want to really focus in on one part of the koan, which is this subtle touch releases the brightness. So first of all, what is the subtle touch? And in this case, it's, you know, if the bodhisattvas are in the bath, it's probably something to do with the subtle touch of water. You know, so if you're in a bath or a shower, or even if you drink a cup of tea, you know for yourself if it's hot or cold. And you don't have to figure that out. You just know it. But that's the subtle touch. It's your awareness, your contact with the water. So in a really important way, the subtle touch is, it's kinesthetic. It happens in the body. It happens through the senses. It's not something that we have to perform or figure out or sort of effort towards. But awakening happens through the body, through the senses, in full contact with them. So tonight, as we sit here, we partake of the subtle touch of the clock, of voices down the hall, sometimes of rap in the cars that are going by in Oakland. Those are some of the subtle touches that we're aware of. And those subtle touches always have full potential for our awakening. It's never something that we have to sort of actively direct ourselves towards, except to just show up. It's something that's always happening into and through our body. So what is this brightness that it releases, the subtle touch? The subtle touch releases the brightness. What is that? Well, in Zen, you know, there's a lot of metaphors about light or brightness. And the brightness is your awakening. It's the place that you came from, and the place to which you will return. We, sometimes in our tradition, we use the metaphor of a wave, that, you know, there's this sort of ocean of essential nature, and when we're born, it's like a wave forming. This kind of comes up out of the ocean, and it takes a particular form, and it has a life that looks sort of individual and particular and has its own trajectory and maybe some sort of, could be big or small, and there's foam coming off of it, it has its own pattern. Different waves have different qualities, but they all, eventually they rise and fall back into the ocean. So the wave is our particular nature, the Susan-ness or the Aaron-ness of any one of us that has particular qualities and individuality. But the wave is never separate from the ocean. And it's part and parcel of it. It's made of the same stuff. It's not separate in any way. It's just kind of rising and falling. So the wave of you rises briefly from the essential nature and is made of it. But what tends to happen for most of us is that we lose our connection to the ocean as we're waves. We forget. We feel separate. We feel solitary. And that makes us feel a certain kind of exile. It's like there's an amnesia that happens, and we forget that we're completely and entirely ocean. Completely and entirely brightness. And we get caught in fear and confusion. And we feel like we're separate and we're flawed. There's something missing. There's something wrong. There's something that we have to search for. And it's not, you know, it's just very human. It's not such a terrible thing. I think for many of us, that's what brings us to do this, to practice. It's a way of remembering who we really are. It's a way of touching into that brightness. I think many people who meditate have, there are those glimpses, there are those moments where things are radiant. You know, there's that moment where that really annoying ticking of the clock is just perfect. It's like reassuring, there it is, full and complete in and of itself, just for a moment. And especially in a longer meditation, whether it's a day-long retreat or a longer retreat, things can seem to start to shine. You know, it's like they're lit from within. Things are luminous. And that's when people come to me and they say things like, oh, my meditation is terrible, but everything is shining. So your brightness is right here. This is it. It's not something else. It's not somewhere else. It's not someone else. And the thing that is so amazing is that when we meditate, we have to sit with what's happening, and so often that can be pain or sadness or boredom or fear. And your brightness is there too. That is it too. And it's an amazing thing when we can feel like that. When we're willing to go there, when we're willing to sit in the place that we're most afraid of, the thing that we're most averse to, and we can find that the light dawns there. That it's by going into that, into the difficulty, into the darkness, into the pain, into the thing that we want to avoid, that that's where we find the light. That's where the brightness reveals itself. Amazing. And that is a gift. That is a real gift of this practice. This light, it can seem like an exotic thing. It can seem to us like a thing that we don't know that much about. But I find that many, many of us have had experience of this brightness, the light, as children. And sometimes we forget, or we kind of discount it, and you know, it's hard to tell somebody about it. It's hard to sort of claim it and make it real when you're a kid. But one story about this actually comes from the life of the Buddha. So, if you're aware of the kind of bigger outlines of his story, after he left the palace, he joined a group of ascetics, and that was the dominant practice of the time, people who were starving themselves and doing practices that were very difficult on the body, that were about sort of denying the body. And he did this until he was close to death. And then he had a dream, and a young woman brought him a bowl of rice milk. And he was debating whether or not to eat this, and that would symbolize not being ascetic so much anymore. And as he was debating this, he had a memory from when he was a child. And it was a memory of... So he was a young prince, right? So he had a pretty good, you know, life in many ways. He had privilege. And the memory was of the first day in the spring that the fields were going to be plowed, to be planted. And his father was there kind of directing things and helping out. And he was a young boy sitting under a tree. And he lay back, and there were the sounds of people working, and it was spring, and he was kind of lying under it was a rose apple tree. And he was looking up. And it was just this sort of sensory experience of how perfect it was to be lying under this tree and having this experience and seeing the bugs and the flowers and the scent of the grasses and the sounds of the people who were familiar to him. So it's his subtle touch, you know, in that moment. And in that moment, he felt the brightness. He knew the brightness for himself. And there was this, everything was perfect. Nothing was incomplete. Nothing was left out. Nothing was lacking. And as he held this bowl, you know, probably 25 years later of rice milk, he remembered that, and what that made him realize is that the way is not one of denial of the senses, of the body. It's actually of participation, of intimacy with the body and the senses. And that reveals the brightness. It's not through self-denial. It's not through flogging oneself. But it's by moving closer, by moving in, by allowing and softening and being receptive. And that was the Buddha's moment of remembering the brightness that he already knew. It wasn't something that he had to deny himself in order to achieve. He had already tasted it, and he remembered that. And he remembered that the way that happened was by it was sort of accidental, but it was by allowing for the subtle touch that was already happening. And I think many of us have these moments as kids, you know. And then we don't have a way to feel that that's important, or most of us don't talk about it. You know, it just gets a little lost or a little buried. When I went to Colorado, I actually had a memory. I hadn't been to Colorado much in my adult life until I went last month. But I had gone for probably 3 summers when I was, I'm thinking maybe between 8 and 10 or something. And I didn't realize until I got to where the retreat was, it was outside of Colorado Springs. And so it was a very distinctive kind of ecosystem with aspen trees and firs and mountains and certain kinds of wildflowers. And after I kind of settled in, I realized, oh my God, I've been here before. And it brought back this memory of when I was there. It was like it just came charging fully into my mind. So when I was, I'm thinking I was about 9, and my mother was a single mother, and she didn't have much money. And so in the summers, she packed me and my sister up to go on camping trips in Colorado, like car camping, you know. And we went to an area that I have since asked her and confirmed with her was not too far from Colorado Springs. And we would do like rafting and camping kinds of things with a Sierra Club. She was in the Sierra Singles. She was looking for a Sierra Club guy, which she eventually found. But there was this one morning where we had been rafting and we were camping, and there was a group of maybe 8 tents. And for some reason this morning I was the first one up. And there was smoke still rising from the campfire, you know, just that kind of ashy kind of smoke. And there were orange tents. And there were rafts sort of pulled up on the river. And there was a canyon. And I could smell the campfire, and I could see the tents, and I could feel the coolness before the heat starts to rise, you know. And it was completely vivid. And I had forgotten that light in that early morning in a campsite in Colorado. That was a rose apple tree moment for me that had gotten completely buried until I went back to Colorado. It's a sense memory, you know. It never became a story. You know, oh, I remember that time when I was 9. You know, that never happened. But when I could see the trees, when I could feel the humidity and the altitude, it came rushing back in my body. And that's the subtle touch that reveals the brightness. One of the old Chinese masters, Master Ma, said, "For countless eons, not a single being has fallen out of the samadhi of Dharma nature. In the samadhi of Dharma nature, we wear clothes and we eat food. We talk and reply to each other. That's the brightness." And about 1,000 years later, a Japanese Zen teacher, Keizan Jokin, said, "When the great earth appears, this samadhi becomes air, earth, wind, and fire, mountains, trees, rivers, grasses, flesh and blood, bones and sinew." That's the brightness. So if this brightness is all around us, it is us, it's right here now, what blocks us? why can we so often be walking around with a feeling of darkness or heaviness or confusion? I think a lot of it is fear, a feeling of needing to protect ourselves. It's a feeling of, you know, being that wave and needing to kind of hold on to something, protect something. Self-concern. It's our small story of who I am and what I can and can't do and what's been done to me or what I've done. And we forget about the ocean. Or if we remember it, it's with a feeling of fear that if we fall back into that ocean, we lose ourselves, and that we need to protect something about the wave that we are. It's a fear of allowing the small mind to dissolve. And an unwillingness to allow ourselves to expand, to be part and parcel of the siren or the clock. The bustle of the city or the stillness of the lake. So we contract, we clench. We tell stories in our minds about who we are and what should or shouldn't happen. And that can obscure. It makes us, we can't show up for the subtle touch that releases the brightness. So this koan is also really a lot about sangha, because the 16 bodhisattvas, you know, they get into the bath together. So here we are, right? We're in this bath together. We're cooking. And so that's, you know, the way of relationships. And of course, it's sort of Buddhism 101 that we're all interconnected and we're all interpermeated. We're not separate, discrete beings. And part of what happens when we come together is we can experience that. You know, people have often remarked here how much different it is to sit together, to practice together, to have a community. And that's a great thing. It's great to support ourselves and each other in our practice. But it's also a way of viscerally experiencing the interpermeation that we always are. There's the image of Indra's net, you know, that reality is this, so that it's this series of jewels, and each jewel reflects all of the other jewels. So there's this sort of really complex weaving of jewels, but it's really not about the jewels, it's about the relationships between them. It's about the ways that we reflect each other and that we give rise to each other. That in this moment, I don't exist without you all, and vice versa. So there's a really complicated thing that happens that we kind of don't often pay that much attention to. Part of the beauty of Sangha is that we get to kind of run along those lines, you know, the interconnections between the jewels, and we get to see what that's like, you know, what it's like in those spaces in between. And you know, one of the questions is, you know, what's it like for us to enter this bath together? What are we doing here? What's it like? in this Sangha, you know, we're all lay people. We're not monks. We're not priests. We're people with busy and complicated lives. And that's our practice. And which is a real gift. It means that we get to take our practice into our lives and into our work and into our relationships. But it also means that we bring all of that richness that we have into our Sangha life. So there's a lot that's perking in our bath, the bath that we enter together. But one of the through lines, part of what makes us Sangha instead of some other, you know, club, is that part of what we're really interested in together is not just the story, you know, the individual story or even the group story, but on the larger opportunity to touch the brightness and to touch it together, to enter the bath together, where something, you know, it's so sort of beautiful that together, at the same time, they all realize the cause of water. And by cause of water, it's not like H2O, you know, it's not like what, it's, you know, what is this to be in a bath together and to be, you know, I'm kind of imagining them almost like playing and like splashing each other, you know. So they experience what that's like to do together. And together, like immediately, I love this image, the 16 bodhisattvas, at the same moment, oh, we realize the cause of water. This subtle touch reveals the brightness.
So, can I say something? Mm-hmm. Do you like us to wait till the end?
You can say something.
So, yes, because I got tripped up on the cause of water.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I was trying to think of, like, what causes water.
Right.
But then I switched it to what is water's cause.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's more like the way you're talking.
Yeah, right, that's good. Well, you're getting the I think something about the koans, which is they can be a little bit tricky with words sometimes, mm-hmm. and so we have to kind of play with them. You know, they're never asking us for like a logical explanation, you know, but you kind of did the little sort of judo move there and kind of switched it around.
Like, almost like what, it's not exactly the right word, but like purpose, cause. Purpose.
Yeah, what's although...
cause function. Yeah.
Right, what's the nature of it? What's it like? What's the experience of it? Yeah, right. Walt Whitman said, "What is it that I interchange so suddenly with strangers? You know, what is it that moment when, you know, you're just walking down the street and you catch somebody's eye, you know, and there's something happens. It's just like that, you know. The brightness is revealed. Just like that. And who knows why? What is that?" And, you know, in the Sangha, we get a chance, you know, we get a chance to kind of rub up against each other. And we get to sort of take up this question of, like, what are we looking for together? What are we looking for in each other, with each other? And in Sangha, we have the chance to kind of agree together that we don't want to turn away. We want to sort of show up for this. That thing that gets exchanged, those moments of brightness. Sometimes they happen together. Sometimes they can feel unwitnessed, you know. But we have a chance here to share something about that. What happens when we don't turn away? But the other part about that, right, is, in Sangha, as in any group, is that there can be a rub. You know, we're different waves, and we have different kinds of trajectories and energies, and sometimes it can feel like we kind of get into a little tension. And we have an opportunity to not turn away from that, to stay with the rub and to try to give it a voice. and to see what the subtle touch of that is. And in order to do that, you know, we need a steady group of people, more or less, and you know, we're finding that. And we agreed to do it together. We agreed to enter the bath together, you know, on Sunday nights. And we hold an intention to cultivate the light, to cultivate the opportunity to reveal the brightness individually, but also together. And that if there are any kinds of splits, that we have the intention to heal that. So in a way, you know, Sangha, entering a Sangha is entering a cauldron. You know, the bathtub is like, it's like that archetype of the cauldron. You know, that's where the alchemy happens. That's where the magic happens. And it's like, you know, the witch's cauldron. You know, anything can happen. And we simmer and cook together. And in doing that, we release the brightness. We enter and we rub up against each other, and we splash each other, and we feel the water, we hear the clock. It's a place of contact and intimacy. And so even when things feel difficult or uncertain or painful or annoying, we can feel that there's the potential for that touch too, even that touch, to reveal the brightness. But it really helps to be in the bath together.